California live oaks. Explore and picnic in the gardens before the show. Further information available at www.siatricum.com and at kpfk.org.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
It's Friday, June 11th. President Donald Trump says a deal is within reach to end the war in Iran just hours after threatening to strike the country for a third time.
We just made a great settlement of the war with Iran. We probably have a signing maybe in Europe.
It's Thursday, June 11th. Iran says negotiations are ongoing, but nothing finalized yet. The World Cup kicks off its first game in Mexico amid protests. The House rejects extending FISA's warrantless surveillance provision in a rare bipartisan show of opposition against President Trump, this time his temporary appointment of Bill Pulte, a real estate scion, to head the Department of National Intelligence.
We were against moving forward with surveillance authority as long as Bill Pulte remained Donald Trump's choice to be the acting director of national intelligence. We said it and we meant it.
The first heat wave hits the Bay Area ahead of summer, and Los Angeles honors Chicano history, marking Zoot Suit Week. Oakland announces a multi-million-dollar investment to combat illegal dumping. News on these stories and more coming up from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley. This is the Pacifica Evening News. I'm Christina Onnestad. Hours after threatening to escalate attacks on Iran today for a third day, President Donald Trump said he was calling off new military strikes in Iran and said a deal's been reached to end the U.S.-Israeli war on the country.
We just made a great settlement of the war with Iran, and we're going to be subject to finalization of documents. We should get done over the next few days. We'll probably have a signing maybe in Europe.
Trump had threatened major strikes on Iran and to seize control of its oil and gas industries on Karg Island oil terminal as fears mounted escalating attacks between the countries were pushing the Middle East closer to full-scale war. Trump told reporters at the White House today the U.S. is close to signing a deal that includes no nuclear weapons. Iran has long said it does not have nuclear weapons.
And most importantly, we have a deal that Iran will never have a nuclear weapon, which was the whole purpose of what we had to go through to get this. So it was a big, very big thing.
Trump, on multiple occasions over the last several weeks, has claimed warring parties have been on a cusp of a deal without anything coming to fruition. Iran has not yet confirmed it's agreed to terms with the U.S. on a settlement to end the war, but Ismail Begay, the spokesperson for Iran's foreign ministry, said in a live phone call on state television today the text of a deal was mostly finalized to end the conflict that began February 28th when the U.S. and Israel jointly attacked Iran. Begay said U.S. aggression impacted the diplomatic process, but mediators are still active, both Pakistan and Qatar.
In terms of the text, I can tell you that the text is mostly finalized. The problem is that the contradictions in America's position has caused turbulence to this process. We are doing our job about the agreement, about the details and the text. Whenever we reach a conclusion that supports the interest of the people of Iran, we will clearly announce that. Until this moment that I'm speaking to you, we have not reached a final conclusion in this regard.
Trump was pressed about the deal to end the war by a reporter at the White House. He clarified, it's an MOU.
It's a very strong memorandum of understanding. That is a little conceptual, but it's something that's going to get done. And if it doesn't get done for any reason, which I can't imagine that not happening, they want to sign it as much as I do or more. I would say they want to sign it more, maybe a lot more. But it's a very detailed a memorandum of understanding, also agreed to by many other countries that have great influence over them, and everybody wants it done. So it's going to get done.
Meanwhile, Iranian state media reported today that Iran fired on U.S. military sites targeting radar systems in Bahrain, hitting 18 targets in Kuwait, and launching a dozen strikes on an airbase in Jordan, claiming to hit areas housing U.S. F-15, F-16, and F-35 fighter jets. Today, the United Nations welcomed reports of de-escalation. Stéphane Dujarric is spokesperson for the U.N. Secretary General.
The only way forward is through genuine dialogue and negotiations. He calls on the United States and Iran to redouble efforts towards a peaceful, comprehensive, and durable agreement that advances regional and international peace and security.
India summoned a U.S. diplomat today to lodge a formal complaint about U.S. attacks on a commercial ship in the Gulf of Oman that killed three Indian sailors. Ishan Garg with Feature Story News reports from India.
In a statement, India's Ministry of External Affairs said incidents of attack on shipping in the region are deeply worrisome and a direct result of the ongoing conflict in the region, and added that New Delhi is calling for immediate de-escalation of tensions. It's the first instance of New Delhi issuing a demarche or an official protest to an American diplomat since the Trump administration came to power last year. New Delhi says its embassy in Oman is involved as the search for three missing Indian crew members continues. Several Indian vessels and Indian seafarers on foreign vessels remain stranded west of the Strait of Hormuz, with safety increasingly a concern as the situation in the region deteriorates. Ishan Garg, New Delhi.
In the south of Lebanon, Israeli strikes continued today. Malak Harb with the Associated Press reports.
Here in the south of Lebanon, strikes continued overnight and into this morning. In towns like Merjayoun and Laya, meanwhile, the war's impact is stark. Streets are nearly deserted, with only a few cars passing and a handful of people walking. Some shops remain open, but every few meters, a destroyed building or a burned-out car is a reminder of the danger. Christian families who chose to stay live in constant fear, many too afraid to even step outside for basic errands. The war between Israel and Hezbollah that erupted in March has forcibly displaced about 1 million people and killed over 3,500.
That's Malak Harb with the Associated Press reporting. The conflict in the Middle East is expected to slow global growth to the lowest rate since the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic, amid high energy prices, steeper inflation, and increased borrowing costs, according to the World Bank Group's latest Global Economic Prospects report. Global growth is forecast to slow to 2.5% this year, down from 2.9% in 2025. Ai Hong Ko's deputy chief economist and director of the Prospects Group, World Bank.
Obviously, this conflict is coming at a very difficult period. We have had 6 years of successive shocks, and this is another shock. So the government's fiscal space is quite limited. You still have inflation problem in a number of countries. And all in all, it's difficult for governments to react to this shock.
He says the shocks are hitting developing economies hardest. By 2028, economies other than China and India that are developing will have collectively experienced nearly a decade of no progress on narrowing their gap of wealth. The World Bank report finds it's not just hitting developing economies. For the first time since 2023, Europe's central bank is raising its interest rates by a quarter percentage point. Christine Lagarde, head of the central bank, pointed to the war in Iran.
The risks to the growth outlook are to the downside, mainly owing to the war in the Middle East, which has added to the volatile global policy environment. Prolonged disruption of energy supplies could increase energy prices further and for longer than currently expected. These factors would erode real incomes even more and make firms and households more reluctant to invest and spend.
Forecasts for two-thirds of economies have been downgraded relative to January this year. Global growth expected to improve to 2.8% next year in 2027, though it's still below 2025 levels and will remain a 0.4 percentage point below the average of the 2010s, a potential nod to stagflation. The numbers of Americans filing for unemployment benefits rose modestly last week, 4.3%, by 4,000 to 229,000. It's the most since early February before the U.S. and Israel launched attacks on Iran, but still considered a healthy level. It's also more than the 216,000 new applications forecast by analysts. Weekly filings for unemployment benefits are considered a proxy for layoffs. Those figures don't account for those whose unemployment benefits expired but cannot find work or who are only working part-time. The rates are higher also for African Americans. Unemployment for blacks in America, 5.9%. That's lower than April, which was 6.6. The annual reports for Social Security and Medicare trustees released this week paints a stark picture of the future of the two programs that are relied on by tens of millions of Americans. According to the 2026 trustees report, Social Security's retirement trust fund now projected to be insolvent by 2032. 6 years from now. If Congress fails to act before then, the program would only be able to pay benefits using income revenue, triggering an automatic 22% reduction in benefits for retirees, survivors, and their dependents. If Social Security's retirement and disability trust funds are considered together, the combined funds are projected to run out in 2034, resulting in an estimated 17% across-the-board benefit cut. The reports also found Social Security's long-term finances have deteriorated significantly since last year. Over the next decade alone, the program is expected to spend $3.8 trillion more than it collects in revenue. Trustees cite several factors behind that outlook, including lower birth rates, reduced immigration projections, and changes enacted through the One Big Beautiful Bill Act that President Trump signed into law last year. It reduced revenue generated through the taxation of Social Security benefits. Medicare faces similar pressures. The reports do not recommend any policy solution, but urge lawmakers to act sooner rather than later. Trustees note delaying action limits available options and could require more abrupt changes through tax increases, spending reductions, or benefit adjustments in the future. For now, current beneficiaries will continue receiving full benefits. The trustees warn, though, that without congressional action, financing challenges facing both programs will become increasingly difficult to address in the years ahead. A United Nations Refugee Agency report Fines forced displacement due to conflict or persecution around the globe fell in 2025 for the first time in a decade. But the agency warns 118 million displaced people remaining is still high. Barham Saleh is the High Commissioner for Refugees at the UN Refugee Agency.
41.6 million people were refugees at the end of 2025. That figure includes 35.6 million refugees under UNHCR mandate and 6 million Palestinian refugees under UNRWA's mandate. It is 1.2 million fewer than the previous year, and that modest decline is welcome news.
The Global Trends report highlights 39% of the 41.6 million refugees last year were children. 7 out of 10 have lived in exile for more than 5 years, often in poor nations.
Who are the refugees and where are they? 36 of the world's refugees are hosted by just 6 countries, Colombia, Germany, Turkey, Uganda, Iran, and Chad. Nearly two-thirds live in countries neighboring their own. More than a quarter are hosted in the world's lowest, least developed countries. 39% of refugees are children, a proportion far exceeding their share of the world's population as a whole.
The ongoing war in Sudan caused the largest displacement, 9.1 million people affected. Another growing trend they're seeing, displacement is becoming increasingly prolonged.
Today, 70% of refugees are living in protracted situations, defined as situations where refugees have been in exile for 5 years and more, without immediate prospects of a durable solution. That is nearly 25 million people. They include families who have spent not years, but sometimes decades in exile. Children who have grown up knowing no other life.
Projections for 2026 remain bleak, with conflicts in Sudan, Yemen, Myanmar, Iran, and Lebanon displacing millions. The Agency for Refugees says it aims to reduce long-term displacement by the year 2035. The House of Representatives today voted down a temporary extension of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, Section 702 provision, which allows the government to gather intelligence on communications abroad. That's a phone calls, text messages, emails, and other electronic communications of Americans and foreigners alike. Civil liberties advocates have long opposed the provision, but the House's rejection of FISA's 702 was a rare bipartisan show of opposition to President Trump's pick for the temporary director of national intelligence post. KPFA's Max Pringle reports.
President Trump has doubled down on his pick of federal housing finance regulator Bill Pulte, who has no prior intelligence experience. Democratic Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries of New York said Trump and the Republicans are putting partisan politics ahead of national security.
In the middle of sensitive negotiations to reauthorize surveillance authority, which they knew were challenging, Donald Trump decides to toss a hand grenade into the middle of those negotiations to blow them up because Donald Trump decided he wants to elevate Bill Pulte, who is nothing more than a malignant political hack who is in no way, shape, or form qualified.
Senate Republicans have urged Trump to pick someone with more experience rather than appointing a political ally. House Speaker Mike Johnson blamed Democrats for the stalemate. The Louisiana Republican said the country is now less safe because of it.
Today, we just offered a simple, clean 3-week extension of the FISA national security law. The Democrats, 199 of them, voted against a clean 3-week extension for political purposes. And when the bill went down, they applauded. They applauded it. That record and that video is going to live in infamy. I pray that we do not have a serious calamity on our shores over the next few weeks.
House Minority Leader Jeffries said the Democratic caucus was serious when it told Speaker Johnson and the Republicans that no extension bill would be passed until their concerns were addressed.
We said we were against moving forward with surveillance authority as long as Bill Pulte remained Donald Trump's choice to be the acting director of national intelligence. We said it and we meant it.
Senate Democrats, meanwhile, rejected Senate Leader John Thune's request to pass the reauthorization bill by unanimous consent or simple voice vote. Civil liberties advocates have also requested that a warrant be issued before the government could look at communications between Americans and foreign nationals located abroad. Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, known as FISA, expires tomorrow. For KPFA News, I'm Max Pringle.
Officials announced new federal efforts to locate and protect unaccompanied migrant children during a joint press briefing today, where they accused the Biden administration of neglect that led to the abuse of thousands of children. KPFA's Scott Baba reports.
Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche and Homeland Security Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen said about 146,000 unaccompanied minors have been located since President Donald Trump took office, out of what they described as hundreds of thousands of children smuggled in the United States during the Biden administration. Blanche said more than 300,000 remain unaccounted for, though he did not provide independent verification for the figures cited.
More than 475,000 unaccompanied children entered the United States during the Biden administration. 475,000. Over 300,000 cannot be accounted for at the end of 2024. The way that this happened was typically because the criminals calling themselves sponsors trafficked these children to the border, usually committing fraud to do so. And oftentimes the children were abused, assaulted, and certainly exploited.
Mullen said federal agencies, including DHS, ICE, and the Department of Health and Human Services, have worked together to track down children and investigate alleged human trafficking networks and fraudulent sponsorship arrangements.
On the 146,000 we found with their sponsors, though some of them were just wellness checks that we went through that were maybe not vetted correctly, but the child was okay, the person was in the country legally, we were able to check that off. Other ones were criminal, so those that were exporting the children were charging. DOJ is helping with that. Some were in labor trafficking rings, some were in sex trafficking rings. Some we couldn't maybe prove that either the child was being utilized in that way because the child was refusing to speak. We have either found legal sponsors for the child and then have gone through the process of deporting the individuals. The vast majority of the 146 were obtained illegally.
The statement came as Blanche announced the indictment of three Guatemalan nationals in Ohio accused of participating in a migrant smuggling conspiracy involving more than a dozen minors. Prosecutors allege the defendants used false identities and claims of family relationships to obtain custody of children after they entered the country. Angie Salazar, acting head of the Office of Refugees Resettlement, said her office has strengthened protections for migrant children.
Today, ORR requires valid identity documents, fingerprint background checks. We identify repeat sponsors. We require DNA testing when family relationship is claimed. We also verify income, and we physically, most importantly, we physically verify the homes, the addresses, and we meet with sponsors in person. And for the first time, ORR is in lockstep with our law enforcement partners to identify bad actors and protect children. We are prioritizing child safety over placement speed and modernizing our systems to strengthen oversight and accountability.
Blanche argued that the mistreatment of the migrant children was a direct result of Biden's border policies.
I think I'm stating the obvious, that when government fails to protect our borders, it is the most vulnerable who suffer. And this department and this administration has zero tolerance for unlawful activity and is committed to protecting children who suffered the consequences of open borders.
Mullen claimed that sanctuary city policies were central to the abuse, saying that fraudulent and exploitative sponsors have taken advantage of protections that limit cooperation with federal immigration enforcement authorities.
Do you know where we're finding the most of them? Sanctuary cities. Because they know they're safe. That's why they're called sanctuary cities. Because of President Trump's leadership, we're going into sanctuary cities. We have mayors like Mondami in New York who want to say you're not welcome. As a mayor, he knows what's happening on the streets. He knows who he's harboring and at this point in abating. By saying that we can't go operate, we're going to.
President Donald Trump and his officials have made similar claims since the beginning of his second term. Meanwhile, during the recent California gubernatorial primary, Democratic candidate and frontrunner Javier Becerra faced criticism over the federal government's handling of unaccompanied migrant children while he served as Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services. The criticism stemmed largely from a Pulitzer Prize-winning 2023 investigation by the New York Times, which found that HHS, seeking to move children out of overcrowded shelters, placed many with sponsors without sufficient vetting and conducted limited follow-up after their release. Following that report, the Biden administration did implement a series of reforms. HHS strengthened sponsor screening requirements, expanded follow-up services for children after placement, and established additional resources, including a hotline for children in distress. The agency also increased home visits by caseworkers, offered more comprehensive post-release and legal services, and worked to improve oversight of sponsor placements. The U.S. Department of Labor also stepped up enforcement efforts targeting employers accused of exploiting migrant children. I'm Scott Baba, Pacifica Radio, KPFA.
Detained more than 6,200 children during President Trump's second term in office, including at least 500 babies and toddlers, according to data obtained by the Deportation Data Project and analyzed by Pulitzer Prize-winning nonprofit newsroom, The Marshall Project. The analysis found ICE held an average of 226 children per day after President Trump reinstated family detention, up from an average of 24 children during the final year of the Biden administration. The number peaked at more than 550 children in detention in January of this year before declining by mid-March. Advocates and attorneys representing detained families say children have faced poor medical care, inadequate access to education, and conditions they describe as harmful and traumatic. Medical experts warn detention can cause developmental setbacks and long-term mental health effects, particularly for infants and toddlers. Court filings allege some children experienced prolonged illness, mental distress, and inadequate food while held at family detention facilities in Texas. ICE disputed many of the allegations, saying families receive appropriate food, water, and medical care, and that conditions comply with federal standards. The data also showed more than 1,600 children were detained longer than the 20-day limit established under the Flores Settlement, which governs the treatment of minors in immigration custody. As the House sent a message about Bill Pulte to President Donald Trump today, he announced his new nominee to head the Department of National Intelligence permanently, Jay Clayton, the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, a former Securities and Exchange Commission chair. Trump announced the nomination on social media amid pressure from Congress to name a permanent replacement for Tulsi Gabbard, who resigned as DNI head last month. The job oversees the coordination of 18 intelligence agencies. As the U.S. attorney in Manhattan, Clayton oversees the Justice Department's prosecution offices, with a vast portfolio ranging from terrorism and espionage cases to security fraud and public corruption. Though he's no direct experience in national intelligence, he has overseen cases involving national security threats. He took over as U.S. attorney from interim attorney Danielle Sassoon, who resigned in February after refusing to carry out orders from the Department of Justice to drop corruption charges against New York Mayor, at the time, Eric Adams. The case was eventually dropped after prosecutors from Washington submitted a request to a judge. Clayton has also overseen the prosecution of former Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his wife, Cecilia Flores, on drug trafficking charges. Sean Vitka, the executive director at Demand Progress, among the groups demanding FISA reforms, said in a statement, quote, "No Democrat should find solace in the fact that Trump has once again named a partisan hatchet man to be the nation's top spy." Just as Trump asked Bill Pulte to investigate Letitia James and Adam Schiff, he's also asked Jay Clayton to investigate Democrats' ties to Jeffrey Epstein. Both Pulte and Clayton have already shown they will carry out Trump's directive to weaponize the government against his political enemies, putting either of them at the ODNI at a time when Trump is asking for warrantless surveillance powers through FISA is too big of a risk, Sean Vitka said. Under Clayton, the Manhattan attorney's office facilitated the unsealing of thousands of pages of court records from the prosecutions of Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell, documents that were made public as part of the DOJ's release of records related to the late sex offender and his longtime confidant. The Senate Intelligence Committee plans to hold a confirmation hearing for Clayton Wednesday next week, according to the Associated Press, citing anonymous sources. The Soccer World Cup kicked off today in Mexico City with a match featuring co-hosts Mexico versus South Africa. Mexico won. The month-long tournament will include dozens of matches across the continent, U.S., Canada, and Mexico, with people from across the world gathering for the championship that takes place every 4 years. United Nations Human Rights Chief Volker Türk says the global event is meant to bring people together.
The old tradition from the Greeks was that this should also lead to all kinds of truces, for example. It's clear that the environment in which mega sport events, including the World Cup, take place, need to provide a dignified and safe environment for the teams that compete, but also for the supporters, for the whole society, and frankly, for the world.
He appealed for the respect of human rights in light of the Trump administration's crackdown on immigrants.
The old tradition from, I hope, that the issues around racial profiling, around surveillance, around immigration enforcement are not going to affect this World Cup in the way that they have already done. I mean, we have seen some of the scenes, and I really hope that there is a massive rethink of the policies that we have unfortunately seen prevailing, especially in the U.S. at the moment. I also hope that the dehumanization of the other, the dehumanization of migrants, the dehumanization of refugees and asylum seekers is put to an end, because nobody benefits from divisive and polarizing narratives.
Mexico has faced protests leading up to the World Cup, and those protests continue today on the first day of the Games. With a global spotlight on the country, community leaders and activists are staging rallies and protests to bring attention to the local issues, mostly around the amount of money being funneled to FIFA instead of public services. Protesters chanted about President Claudia Sheinbaum, saying Claudia is not an ally, she's privileged. Among those taking to the streets, teachers on strike. This week, ahead of the World Cup, teachers brought business as usual to a standstill in Mexico City. The mobilizing unions demanding a pension overhaul, better working conditions, and a 100% salary increase for workers in the education sector. Mexican riot police fired tear gas. Pedro Hernandez is a teacher spokesperson.
Y el día 11, lo que va a suceder.
And on the 11th, what's going to happen is not the opening kickoff. It's not the celebration of the World Cup that has been taken away from the people. What's going to happen is that thousands of workers, not just in Mexico City, but across the country, will take to the streets during the World Cup of dispossession to say that in this country, there is no response to workers' demands.
Among the dissent, state funds being poured into the FIFA infrastructure while public education remains chronically underfunded. Today, hundreds of relatives of missing people marched towards Mexico City Stadium, carrying photographs of their loved ones and demanding justice for one of Mexico's most persistent human rights crises. Many marchers carried posters bearing the faces of their loved ones who are missing, chanting, "Mexico, champion of disappearances." Mexico has more than 130,000 people officially registered as missing or disappeared, according to government data. Relatives have long accused authorities of failing to adequately investigate disappearances, forcing many families to organize searches and advocacy campaigns on their own. One side read, "Femicide Capital." Families said they hoped the influx of foreign media and visitors could help amplify their calls for answers. Yeltsi Martinez is one of the activists at today's rally.
Aquí matan, aquí desaparecen, aquí violentan a todas las personas. México no es apto para recibir un mundial ni extranjeros. Lo quisieron hacer, pero aquí estamos diciendo que sí existe la desaparición forzada.
Several lines of riot police blocked their access to Mexico City Stadium as supporters streamed in for the first match of the tournament. In a separate rally, students marched from UNAM and other universities today, criticizing government spending and broader social issues. The group, which included members of a Black Bloc contingent, attempted to push through police lines surrounding the stadium. Video shows protesters throwing rocks into their objects while police responded with crowd control devices using explosive noisemakers. The first games in the U.S. will kick off tomorrow in Los Angeles, the first of 78 games to be played in the United States. The tournament will also be split with Canada, but attention has been drawn in the U.S. in recent days due to President Trump's restrictive travel policies that have stopped some players and officials from entering the U.S. Fears of immigration and customs enforcement present at games and the ongoing war with Iran, also among issues, KPFA's Kennedy Quayle reports.
The Men's World Cup has arrived in North America despite concerns over the United States' role as co-host. This tournament is already being heavily impacted by President Donald Trump's anti-migration policies. Somali referee Omar Abdulkadir Atan was denied entry into the U.S. due to, quote, vetting concerns, end quote. Somalia is on Trump's travel ban list. In a recent TV interview, Department of Homeland Security Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen said that no large-scale immigration enforcement actions are planned at World Cup events, but concerns persist about the possible presence of immigration and customs enforcement at the stadiums. the Los Angeles Rapid Response Network, in conjunction with the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights Los Angeles, issued safety guides, including information on what to do in the event of an encounter with ICE. At an event celebrating the beginning of the tournament Wednesday, San Francisco Mayor Daniel Lurie was asked how the city would respond to possible ICE raids.
We have been working for months. Zaylene at the Bay Area Host Committee has done a wonderful job. We had a great run with Super Bowl 60. We know what to expect, and we are prepared for anything. We just work well together. We've worked well with San Jose and the mayor down there and the mayor in Oakland. Like, we're all connected on public safety. We're first and foremost wanting to keep everybody safe, and we're going to do that. We did it for a major event in Super Bowl 60. We'll do it again.
Some observers note that this World Cup will be the least accessible ever put on. This year, for the first time ever, FIFA has allowed dynamic pricing and the resale of tickets. The average price of a ticket to see a group stage game in Qatar 2022 was $11. According to sports site The Athletic, tickets for this tournament are more than 10 times more expensive. And fans have reported discrepancies between the seats they've purchased and those they receive, with some appearing to be in completely different sections of the arena than advertised. The complaints have been severe enough to prompt the Attorneys General of California, New York, New Jersey, and Texas to open investigations into the ticket sale practices. Soccer legends have also spoken out against the pricing, including the Bay Football Club co-founder and former U.S. women's national team player, Leslie Osborne. She has dedicated herself to making attendance accessible to fans and says it is upsetting that the game and event meant to unite people won't be accessible.
Soccer is the world's game. It's one thing that can bring people together regardless of your political views, your background. And so naturally, it will bring people together. They're going to experience the wins, the losses, the highs, the lows, and it unites people. I do wish everyone that wants to go to a game had the access to do that. That's the one part of me that makes me sad, that not everybody will have that.
Another controversy for the games is the fact that this will be the first time a host country is at war with a participating nation. The Iranian team was forced to relocate their base camp to Mexico from Arizona following visa rejections for the duration of the tournament. A statement to ESPN from the U.S. State Department called it necessary, saying, quote, "We will not allow the Iranian team to abuse this system to sneak terrorists into the United States under false pretenses," end quote. Despite all the troubles and controversies, fans of the sport are excited to see its growth and the stories that will come from the World Cup. Curaçao is making history as the smallest country to ever qualify for the tournament. Uzbekistan, Jordan, and Cabo Verde are also making their debuts. The Democratic Republic of the Congo, Haiti, and Iraq are making historic returns after being shut out for over 40 years. Former U.S. women's national team player Danielle Slatin called soccer a powerful force in unifying people all over the world.
Sports has the power to bring people together, and I've been really fortunate to be able to travel the world. And even when I can't speak the same language as the people I'm interacting with, like, we both share the game of football and the love of soccer. And so that is the language that we speak. It is truly the world's game, and so to be able to come together, celebrate the fun, the joy, like all of the feels that football and soccer can bring, I think is really powerful, and quite frankly, it's pretty needed right now.
The World Cup will be a test of how the United States handles a large-scale international event ahead of the upcoming Summer Olympics set to take place in Los Angeles in 2028. For KPFA News, I'm Kennedy Cuello.
Local activists are calling for a boycott of the World Cup and say they'll protest on the first day of World Cup games in Santa Clara this Saturday at Levi Stadium. Organizers, including the Black Alliance for Peace, say a government sustained by war profiteering, mass incarceration, and migrant repression, while supporting a genocide in Palestine and military aggression abroad, should not be rewarded with hosting the world's largest sporting event. A statement from organizers continues, quote, "The World Cup should unite people across borders in the spirit of human dignity and international solidarity. Instead, FIFA has awarded the tournament to a state actively supporting genocide abroad while terrorizing migrants and vulnerable communities at home. We refuse to allow the beautiful game to be used to whitewash empire, militarism, and repression," unquote. They're calling for a boycott to reject what they say is the use of the World Cup as a vehicle for what they say is normalizing war, militarism, political repression, detention, deportation, and impunity. Protests continue in Albania for the 12th day in a row against a Trump family-linked luxury development on an ecological sensitive area. Thousands marched through the capital, Tirana, again against the proposed $1.6 billion luxury tourism development for the elite, linked to President Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and Trump's daughter, Ivanka. Today marks the 12th consecutive day of protest. Demonstrators held banners and chanted slogans against the project, which environmentalists say could damage the unique ecosystem and habitat of the protected Zvernik-Narta Lagoon area and the sensitive species that call it home, including flamingos and sea turtles. The protests against the backroom deal with the rich has sparked a popular uprising across the country and calls for Albania's prime minister to resign. In an interview with the Associated Press Tuesday, Albania's prime minister, Edi Rama, dismissed environmental objections as the result of misinformation and said the development was turning Albania from a country once ignored by investors into one where, quote, big capital wants to come and the big investors want to come, unquote. His actions have drove thousands of demonstrators and protests outside the prime minister's office in the capital daily against the planned development. It includes hotels, apartments, villas, and a marina for yachts. This unnamed speaker addressed a crowd of thousands in the streets today. One protester's sign read, "Revolution of Flamingos, the only species that we want extinct? Corrupted politicians." Blarim Shehu is a 36-year-old protester.
"This project, this mega project that the prime minister is claiming, we don't know nothing about it. There is no transparency in it. We just heard from the media that the prime minister has given a land to the private, and that's why this makes us think that this it's a kind of corruption in it. So when there is no transparency, there is no other than corruption."
The government says the development would be transformational for the former communist nation as it seeks to enter the high-end tourism market and pushes for European Union membership, but the EU has warned against violating its environmental laws. Demonstrators have pledged to continue protesting in the coming days and are demanding the project be canceled, the prime minister to resign. Since late May, heavy machinery has entered the area, sparking outrage. Albania's state anti-corruption agency has now opened an investigation related to the project and has not disclosed any details. The Trump administration is ending the Ocean Observatory's initiative, a network of some 900 deep-sea ocean floor sensors that collect critical data on marine ecosystems, ocean currents, and the climate. Ocean Conservancy calls it one of the most advanced ocean monitoring systems ever built and says its dismantling will waste $368 million in a public investment and puts critical ocean science at risk. The Ocean Advocacy Group warned in a statement, as one of the most severe El Nino cycles in a century looms, threatening marine wildlife, fisheries, coastal communities, and millions who depend on a healthy ocean, decision makers are shutting down one of the very tools designed to track these changes. Ocean Conservancy said the planned closure at the National Science Foundation is in the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025 playbook for Trump's presidency, a right-wing blueprint for a theocratic state. Scientists also warn ending the Ocean Observatory's initiative will reduce ability to monitor changing climate patterns, forecast weather, and detect extreme weather alerts. The administration cites high cost of maintenance for the project, about $48 million. There's no sign of a replacement. Widespread moderate heat risk is anticipated today and tomorrow, Friday, across much of the Bay Area. Moderate heat risk means members of heat-sensitive groups could experience negative health-related impacts like heat illness. Roger Gross is with the National Weather Service.
Yeah, so we actually have a heat advisory across the North Bay and interior portions of the Bay Area as temperatures are forecast to reach near 100 degrees, especially across the interior, like Livermore, Concord, and up in Cloverdale area. Those warm temperatures, we have a widespread moderate heat risk in effect. That's basically, based off of climatology, that we see these threats. Tomorrow will cool down, especially near the coast, as we see more of a marine influence push inland. But the interior East Bay will remain in the heat advisory until Friday night.
According to the Bay Area Weather Service, the Bay Area and surrounding parts of Northern California also saw their first red flag warning of the season this week, a reminder to prepare for hotter, drier conditions as fire season approaches and burn suspensions go into effect across the region. Goss is urging residents to be vigilant in preventing new fires.
Most of the fires are man-made. The only thing that can strike a spark is lightning. Generally, most of they're pretty much preventable in most cases. So, when we see especially dry offshore winds across the Bay Area, and that's when we start getting concerned about the red flag warnings. And so, just don't drag chains on the ground. Campfires can also create a spark.
According to CAL FIRE, California has already seen more than 2,000 wildfires scorch more than 60,000 acres this year. Helpful tips on to preparing for fire season can be found at readyforwildfire.org. Heat advisory stretches across much of California, with Fresno expected to see temperatures in the triple digits. The National Weather Service says the advisory remains in effect until 11 p.m. Saturday. Residents are encouraged to drink plenty of water, never leave children or pets unattended in vehicles, and take frequent breaks in air-conditioned spaces or the shade, if possible, to shift outdoor activities to the cooler parts of the day. Oakland Mayor Barbara Lee announced a major infusion of dollars to tackle one of the city's looming problems, illegal dumping. KPFA's health and well-being reporter Annetta Felix has more.
Oakland's getting $9.275 million over the next 3 years to tackle one of its biggest problems, illegal dumping on the streets. It's a gift from Crankstart, the family foundation of venture capitalist Michael Moritz and Harriet Heyman, which has already invested $80 million into Oakland and Alameda County over the years. Mayor Lee says the partnership will fund the comprehensive dumping strategy she rolled out in April.
Our residents deserve basics, clean streets. They deserve a city that fights for them with every tool available. And also, this is foundational to our economic development. Just know, to bring businesses to Oakland, to bring more conventions to Oakland, more tourism to Oakland, we have to have a clean city.
A city audit in April detailed the extent of the problem. £7 million of illegally dumped waste collected and $12 million spent in the last fiscal year. 2025 saw more than 25,000 illegal dumping cleanup requests. That's about 70 every day. To help prevent illegal dumping, the three-year funding will largely go to enforcement. The city's illegal dumping camera network will more than double from about 35 cameras to nearly 85 trained on dumping hotspots. Public Works Director Liam Garland says when dumping is caught on camera, violators are four times more likely to be identified and cited. The money also funds AI-assisted drone aerial imaging to spot dumping piles before residents even call 311. That system was approved unanimously by Oakland's Privacy Commission. Addressing privacy concerns, Oakland assures the cameras only scan streets and sidewalks and won't be used for enforcement. But Oakland's Deputy Police Chief Anthony Tedesco gave a stern warning to habitual dumpers.
You should be nervous. We are going to end your anonymity. We are going to pull you out of the shadows. And we are going to take the problems that you are dumping on our doorstep back to your doorstep.
So what happens when the cameras catch someone? District 3 Council Member Carol Five told KPFA that under the city's new ordinance, the crime would determine the fine.
We're looking at fines between $500 and $5,000, so it just depends on how egregious the dumping issue is.
Five calls dumping more than a trash problem. She says it's a racial justice and health justice issue for West Oakland, a historically black neighborhood that's bearing the heaviest burden. Community organizers from Faith in Action, ISPE, who packed the hearing room, have spent years pressing the city for exactly this. Barbara Lafitte Oluwole spoke on behalf of Oakland residents.
When illegal dumping shows up on your block week after week, it sends a message. It says that your neighborhood, health, safety, and quality of life doesn't matter. Our communities know better. That's why we have organized. That's why neighborhood leaders have refused to accept illegal dumping as a normal part of life in Oakland.
The April audit on illegal dumping also recommends prevention, like subsidized low-income waste hauling and increased outreach for bulky pickup services, actions the city is also pursuing. The investment will pay for bigger trash containers for residents at no cost, and outreach on the city's free bulky pickup, which renters in apartment buildings can now book directly, no landlord required. The money lands July 1st, with the new cameras expected on the streets within 3 to 6 months. For KPFA Radio, I'm Annetta Felix.
The Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors have designated June 3rd to June 8th as Zoot Suit Riots Remembrance Day. The Tuesday commemoration marks the 1943 attacks in which groups of service members, police officers, and white civilians targeted young Mexican-American, Black, and Filipino Angelenos who wore Zoot Suits, a style of dress that symbolized cultural identity for many young people of color. The violence followed the arrest and prosecution of Mexican-American youth in the 1942 Sleepy Lagoon case, despite weak evidence linking them to the death of Jose Gallardo Diaz. This year's recognition makes it the 83rd anniversary of when the violence took place. Supervisor Hilda Solis, who introduced the motion, said she hopes the Week of Remembrance will honor the communities that experienced racial violence during the riots and highlight the dark moment in Southern California history. She notes the violence was an attack on minority communities who were using fashion as a way to claim their cultural identity.
One of the most shameful episodes in our history in Los Angeles County, the violence that unfolded many years ago in June of 1943 was not spontaneous. It was a result of racism, discrimination, and the deliberate targeting of Mexican American African-American and Filipino-American communities. Many of those targeted were known as pachucos, pachucas, young Mexican-Americans who challenged social norms and asserted their place in Los Angeles through style, confidence, and cultural pride.
She said the acknowledgement is vital as L.A. prepares to co-host the FIFA World Cup.
The attacks against Zoot Suiters were ultimately attacks on culture itself. As Los Angeles prepares to welcome the world,
the quadrennial Men's World Cup soccer tournament is the most popular event in the world. As such, it provides a unique window into the soul of contemporary humanity. Indeed, it requires much more than what you get from usual sports broadcasting. And that's what we deliver here on KPFK, and every Friday at 5 p.m. throughout the tournament, tune into The People's Game, the special series that looks at the economic and political subtext of the tournament, as well as the joys and passions of the game on the field. This year's tournament is hosted by Mexico, Canada, but mostly Donald Trump's America. And thus, no World Cup has ever required the type of coverage that The People's Game provides. Just as there's never been a better moment to declare that The People's Game belongs to the people. So join us as we analyze and celebrate The People's Game right here on KPFK Fridays at 5 p.m.
You're listening to KPFK 19. 19-